Synchronized is sponsored by the Production Music Association, the leading advocate and voice of the production music community. Become a member and help us to fulfill our mission. Go to pmamusic.com and click on membership for more info and to sign up.
Episode 31 and the last one of 2021. Simon, can you believe that?
That's amazing, Ferry, isn't it?
Where did the time go?
Yeah. Yeah. It's been great fun, hasn't it?
Absolutely. And it's going to be even more fun next year because we're just going to continue doing what we're doing, right?
Yeah.
And we just need to find more interesting guests so we can talk more about the production music industry, what's going on right now, where we're going, where we're heading, what's the future, how we're going to make money in 2022. I think that's the goal.
So we've got a very interesting guest tonight, Ferry.
I think so. It's Marcio Skena from A-Note Music. Hi, welcome, Marcio.
Hi, guys. Hi, Ferry. Hi, Simon. Great to be here with you today.
You're welcome.
I just think it's a good idea to explain first a little bit about A-Note Music. So you can tell us what A-Note Music actually does, how it works. And then we want to know more about you as a person. Do you like music? You know, do you play music? All that sort of stuff.
Makes sense. That's kind of the agenda for today. A-Note is the marketplace for music rights. So we have created an online marketplace where owners of music, which is anybody that in his career has been developing or producing music, generates some rights through which we have we provide value. We determine the value of music and we give the opportunity to the music right owners to sell a portion of these rights, to monetize, and to have the fan base or external investors to buy a fraction of these music rights. So we empower the music industry with a new form of financing and connection with whoever loves music.
Can I just say that it's like a stock exchange for music rights?
Yes, exactly. It's an exchange. Properly said, a stock exchange is where you trade, securities, stocks or bonds. In this case, we're talking about the pure right, the pure intellectual property and royalty-generating asset at the end of the day, which can be exchanged between parties right now freely and in a transparent way thanks to marketplace that we created.
Okay, that's interesting. Before we go further on A-Note Music, can you tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Sure. So where shall I start? I mean, I don't know if your audience from the accent can tell, but I'm originally and I'm Italian. And I've been living in Luxembourg in the last 5 years. And 4 years ago, I came out with this idea of connecting what I really know a lot, which is finance and financial markets, with an industry that everybody on earth loves, which is the music industry. So, yes, I come from the business side, let's say, investing in stuff like Apple, Amazon, Tesla, derivatives, boring stuff at the end of the day that everybody's looking at. And with my future co-founders, we created A-Note as the great opportunity of discovering the untapped market of music royalties. So, straight out of, university, I did 2-3 years. In an investment fund, and then here I am.
Great. So can I dive in with a question straight away, Ferry? How do you place a value on a piece of music that's just been written? That must be a challenge.
Yeah, that's just been written. It's a very big challenge. What we do, our sweet spot is for catalogs that have been already generating some royalties, on which you can base on historical performance and music consumption habits, you can more or less derive value. For something which is totally new, it's more complex, because in that case, you want to look at who is actually going to, push the song out, who is the record label, who is the publisher, and then you want to know more or less, also track record of who are the songwriters and who is, of course, the artists that are going to perform the song. So you can base yourself on similar content produced by the same people that wrote this song.
So most of your clients, people who have kind of got a degree of experience in the business, or do you get a lot of newcomers approaching you?
A huge amount of newcomers. I mean, we spend a lot. At the end of the day, it's our job, right? To make the make normal people discover the music industry under a different, point of view, which is truly understanding what happens behind the scenes. Everybody is who is listening to music, which is basically, I say, 99% of the population on Earth, doesn't have a clue about how you produce music and what are the economies behind. So our job is also to educate, you know, people to understand that there are royalties. What are royalties? You know, it's already something which is, let's say, an advanced concept for the, let's call it, the man of the street. I buy a CD and then somehow there is some money which is flowing into the pockets of the artists. This is the educational thing that we do.
What I think is interesting is because you were investing in companies like Apple, Tesla. What made you decide music? That's a great commodity.
Yes, actually, I was starting because I wanted to bet on who would win the Sanremo Festival. Sanremo Festival is kind of Eurovision festival, which is in Italy. You know, I identified the song that I knew that would actually make it as first in the festival, in the competition. And I couldn't find a way to do it, you know, like there was no way of betting or investing. And then I tried to, you know, make it bigger. Is it possible to invest in music? Why is the music business so cryptic? Why is it so much not transparent? Why is it the only sector on Earth that doesn't have access to financial leverage? And so this is how everything started. And then speaking with, you know, former executives in the sector, we understood that there is a huge market, which was totally secretive, let's say, from this point of view, at least 4 years ago when we started.
So why do you think it's still secretively?
I think it's opening up. You see in the headlines, big artists, very famous artists and big investment funds entering into the arena, buying, you know, to the higher 1% of the music catalogs. So somehow people right now are understanding a little more the economics of the business, also the streaming. The streaming revolution of 4 or 5 years ago, everybody was still somehow depressed because let's remember that the music industry for 15 years has been in a bear market, so moving down, you know. So right now, I think that it's much less secretive. There are more opportunities, you know, I think for also independence. It's less dependent on, you know, the big money coming in the industry. And also our solutions, you know, this democratization process, I think I'm at help here.
Are there unique challenges to the music business that you haven't found in other areas before? Or is it kind of basically formulaic? You can take one industry and examine the music industry similarly.
Well, for sure there are peculiarities, as in any business. You know, it's a business which is very interesting because it's a business where you have creativity, a lot of marketing. And this is the most complicated point to discuss, I think. And as well, you know, kind of management components come together. So from an external point of view, you only see the creativity aspect. But then in order to, you know, to have music, reach a huge amount of fan base, you really need to push on communication and marketing and visibility. Nowadays, it's very important to have the artist tour, of course, as always, even during COVID, I mean, somehow. And then be present in the social. So there is all this marketing and communication component, which is what makes the music industry capital intensive at the end of the day. So these are, I would say, the most complex parts to understand.
So is there any sort of feedback loop between the marketing side of things and the investment side of things? I mean, are the marketeers investing, for instance?
Well, consider that when I speak about communication and marketing, it's when you need to push a song out or when you have something new that you want it to be, to reach as many people as possible. But then there is kind of, you know, something amazing happens, which is after a few years that a song comes out, it either goes down and then it doesn't enter the popular culture. But there are many songs that actually make it after 5 years and then they have this stability phase. And whatever you're going to do, you can just somehow, let's say, I mean, many publishers are not going to agree with what I'm saying, that somehow you can just be much more passive than at the beginning of, you know, when a song is released. So this is a sweet spot that we focus on, which is music that by playing on music consumption habits and people that listen to the song over and over again is somehow the, you know, what makes music somehow unique and similar to, I don't know, having an apartment in central London, I would say.
So something that strikes me is that artists who are just starting off very often don't have a budget for marketing, but your platform would enable them to monetize, to give a part of the song to the marketeers and that way pay for marketing. Is that something that happens?
Yes, this is also another way of seeing. So you have possibly two solutions. One is what we say, which is leverage the old to produce the new. So you have steady income flow, royalties and revenues that come from your production of the past. You can somehow monetize this and receive, you know, some funds in order to produce new content. And then the other opportunity is somehow through our fractional ownership of music rights, engage with somebody that can own a piece of your music and then, you know, bring them on board like you do with startups, right? I mean, you need a CTO, so you're going to give to your future co-founder a portion of the company so that you work both in the same direction. That's a very nice, I would say, way. And this is already what's happening in the business. At the end of the day, when you onboard a record label or a publisher, you already give to these guys 50%, 20%, 60% or whatever, you know, of your music production. So I think that this is the most important aspect to focus on, which is even if you monetize, even if you have funds, you always want to have somebody from the business that will help you from marketing, administration, portfolio management, or reaching out to the specific fund base here and there. You know, all these parts that are somehow business rather than creativity-based.
Can I try to make the conversation a little bit more concrete? Because the listeners of Synchronized are mostly working in the production music industry. Mm-hmm. Let's, for example, say there is a composer who has a catalog, and his catalog has been generating for the last 10 years $100 per year, right? And he thinks, okay, there are probably two options. He wants extra money because he wants to invest in new equipment, or he wants to build a studio, whatever. Or maybe he wants to sell his catalog. That's the other extreme option. He just wants to stop. And how would you value that? Can you give us... I'm not asking for an exact number. I'm just trying to find out what the what the mechanism is.
Yes. So usually when you, what you do with catalog is you use the multiple approach. So how much a song or a catalog... I mean, usually we speak about catalogs, right? So it has been generating in the past, and then you apply a multiple anywhere in between 6, 5, and up to 16, 17, sometimes you even see 20. And then you go and then you have the valuation of the catalog of the songs, and then you, based on this, you decide what percentage are you interested in selling. I mean, on our platform, what we do is that we focus on the royalties. So we are, from this point of view, innovative because we don't care about the ownership of the underlying rights. You keep the ownership. This is very, very important. Also, we have a buyback clause. So if you want also to get back the royalties in the future, you get this back, right? You just need to pay the market price and then you get them back. And this is an innovative approach because until this moment, the multiple approach is also something that you see in the normal market of music royalties. You can have a publisher, you can have a record label, which is buying, let's say, your catalog based on a multiple of historical performance. And regarding what is the multiple, because I provided a wide range, right, between 5 and 6 to 16. Well, it depends on how iconic is the catalog, how stable, is it growing, is it not. If it's growing, of course, you're going to go in the higher level. If it's very old, of course, you will achieve a premium, you know, it will be priced higher. If it's big, this is something which is not very, you know, intuitive to understand, but the bigger catalog is, the higher the multiple as well. If you are giving away control, then the multiple is going to be higher. You know, there are many factors as well. The genre from, you know, financial modeling point of view is the most important determinant. If you're in the right genre, it's going well, it will continue to go well, and you will have a premium.
Can you tell me a little bit more about which genre is very popular?
So I would say maybe hip-hop. It's pretty important right now. There was a moment a few years ago in which you had country as one of the, you know, the genre. But this is very cyclical, you know, like it depends. It depends on the decade. It depends on the year. It depends, of course, on the listening habits of the people at the moment. Because what is amazing about the music industry is that many times you have something unexpected happening. I mean, I don't know, maybe there is a new genre that was not in the last decade relevant, and then it becomes relevant anymore. It's like the fashion, you know, the fashion industry. All of a sudden, Armani does something in its new fashion show, you know, based on something he produced in the 70s, and then everyone is going back to the 70s. But of course, you know this.
So basically, we lost Simon, by the way, if people are thinking, why can't we hear Simon? He kind of was kicked out of the recording session, so he's trying to log in again. Okay. So basically, a hip-hop catalog can be worth more in 2 years' time because it's more popular than it's now, just for example? It fluctuates?
Well, yeah, I mean, from the point of view of understanding the numbers behind why a specific genre is more popular, I mean, it's demanding a premium in terms of valuation, there are probably many factors that kick in. Probably it's also the audience, how young is the audience, and how, you know, from this point of view, how sticky are they to a specific genre. And also you have, I mean, another genre which is totally different, which is very valuable, is the rock. You know, if you happen to have, you know, some rock production from the 70s or 80s, this could be very valuable. Why? Because the moment that it reaches popularity, it was many years ago, and now it's super stable. I mean, it's only positively exposed to the increase in streaming, to the possibility of using it as soundtracks for whatever movie, or even the metaverse. This is also something that many players in the industry are looking right now. Because you enter into this metaverse, you know, with your goggle or whatever, you will need to have a soundtrack. I mean, it's not, you cannot be in the desert, let's say. So these are all things that you want to look at, the exposure that you can have to kind of these opportunities with your music.
Simon is back. Hello, Simon.
Hi there.
Good to see you again.
I don't know what happened there.
We kind of lost you.
Marcio, do you make a distinction between commercial music and production music?
We don't personally, of course, I mean, we are totally agnostic from this point of view. But for sure, I mean, it's important the fan base, what the fan base is looking at, and the investors, how they think that the catalog is going to buy Iconic and going to be staying like this for a long number of years, for a high number of years. So the more Iconic, the more commercial potentially, the more people are going to say, aha, I love this music. And so let's remember that on our platform, we have normal people, you know, participating. People that until yesterday, they were probably looking at investing, I don't know, 5% of their worth in houses. And then again, for a diversified portfolio. And then now they see music and they say, okay, is it something I'm understanding? Yes. Is there a song that I actually love? Yes. So the more Iconic, again, the more, you know, connection, personal connection with the music you can engage with investors, the more important it is.
So, I mean, we've been looking at statistics of what percentage of music used on television is commercial music, i.e. pop music, and what percentage is production music, which is what we do. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. we're quite high. It's like over 40% of the music used on British TV is production music. Now, there are no real fans for that. There might be fans for legacy production music, but it's a very functional kind of music. It does a job. And as you say, it kind of needs turnover to keep it going. But nevertheless, it's seriously earning money. And the commercial music side is looking at us going, these guys, they're still making money on that. You know, we want some of that. So, do you think there's an increasing part that the production music area can play, or do you think it's kind of because it's less trendy, less kind of in your face, it's not quite so appealing to investors?
No, it's definitely very, I mean, from this point of view, it's definitely very appealing, but I think that there is a big difference here to make. I mean, music which is going to stay there, like, I don't know, for decades, no matter what, so where you don't need really to have an active management behind. Because there are people that when they have they whistle this music under the shower and then they listen on it on Spotify and so on and so forth. Instead for music where you need to have, you know, somehow a player behind, a player in the industry, which is, you know, pushing it and making sure that it's used, synchronized, and, you know, all this is also something that we really touch and where we are very strong in, which is less connected to the artist and the songwriter behind, but more connected with the player in the industry to which we provide financial leverage. So we are speaking, for example, with publishers or producers or record labels that are independent. They want to grow. They want maybe to digitalize, you know, the presence and so on and so forth. So they sell a percent of their catalog, which is not, let's say, maybe Iconic, but it's very stable. That's where we see the highest level of stability, more than, for example, in more commercial music, which is then maybe a little bit more up and down. So as I was saying before, the level of stability of a catalog is very, very relevant. So as long as with production music you can achieve through your active management stability and you're not selling 100% of the catalog, that's amazing. This is something that investors are indeed looking at. It's what we call, it's what people in the financial industry call a cash cow. You know, you have a cow producing not milk but cash at the end of the day, or royalties. So it's, yeah.
So how does it work? If I'm a composer and I'm doing business with A-Note Music, I'm getting... money from you guys because investors are investing in my catalog, then it probably means that all the royalties that are come from performing rights organizations mm-hmm. are being paid to A-Note Music or the investors directly. Is that correct?
Yes, you do a letter of direction. So basically you go to the, you knock on the door of the PRO and you say, okay, from this moment on, I mean, 10%. And we also do deals for limited duration. So maybe 10 years, limited term, or for 5 years or for 15 or for the life of rights. Sometimes you can directly do an assignment. So if you do a complete sale, you're going to say, okay, this rights, portion of this is going to be of the investors and represented by A-Note, so that we make sure that, but yeah, it's very important to, you know, plug and play with whoever is paying royalties, what we call the underlying royalty distributors. Okay. Very, how to say, yeah.
So, and then A-Note Music gets that income, right? And you distribute it to the investors.
Correct. This is what we do.
So, but the composer keeps some of it, or does he always give you all of it? I mean, how, or is it, it's just negotiable?
Yeah, put yourself, to answer this question, I'm going to put yourself in the shoes of an investor, you know, like where he's saying, okay, there is somebody interested in selling a portion of his music rights. Maybe he knows something that I don't. So it's much more reassuring if this person, being the composer, an artist, a record label, is only selling a minority share or a small percentage. So that you somehow you already show commitment, you know, for staying in charge of the catalog and for continuing the activities that you have been doing in the past, which is either touring or promoting the catalog or doing the right publishing behind it or making the administration of it. You know, this is also the sweet spot, how you can basically participate. Think about, I don't know, the stock exchange. When a company, when Facebook got listed, Mark Zuckerberg didn't sell 100%, you know, on the Nasdaq. He sold just as many minority share, a very minority share, because investors are interested in Mark Zuckerberg, continues managing. I don't know if it's the case right now anymore, but back in the days it was. So yeah, this is also what we do. I mean, on our platform, we focus on minority transactions.
Okay, basically what you're saying, if a composer wants to sell 100% of his rights, people probably think, he doesn't believe in his own recordings anymore, his own compositions anymore.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, it happened, for example, in the past where we were looking at the catalog, for example. They were demanding a slightly too high price, but okay. And then the problem is that doing the diligence, and I wanted to sell 100%, and then doing the diligence, we saw that they had the majority of the income connected with a synchronization with a gym. A chain of gyms, let's say. So, and this synchronization was coming to an end in, I think, like 9 months from the moment that. So, you know, there is always something that, especially for music that maybe is not, doesn't generate the highest percentage from streaming, there's always something that you need to take care of and to look into. And so whenever somebody's selling 100%, you know, you need to look into this a little bit.
And are your deals global or are they territorial? I mean, do you divide up into territories or do you just deal globally?
For the royalty generation, globally. I mean, it depends on, you know, whatever publisher or the producer or the songwriter is receiving, we deal with this.
And where are your principal investors? Are they from America, Europe, or China, or India, and places all over?
We have most of our investors, we don't promote actively outside of our core market, which is Europe. So this is where the vast majority of our investors are.
Okay. And are you planning to move into America? Is that on your...
Yes. We can see him smile. So yeah. The answer is yes, listeners. Yeah.
Yeah. This is a trade secret. Yeah.
I mean, the American market is a very, very interesting market. And of course, it's something that we have been looking at. And it's very important whenever you enter into a new territory to have somebody there, you know, on the spot, and you know, to help out, to do a strategic partnership with. So this is what we are always open to.
And are you subject to legislation that doesn't normally apply to music because you're a trading platform which differs in each territory, presumably? Yeah, so America might have its own trading laws.
Yes, from this point of view, the United States is a little bit more complex because in Europe, what we do is we are a marketplace for music rights, right? So we don't securitize, we don't create at the end of the day, we don't create tokens, for example. I mean, as instead in other industries I've been seeing, which is another form of securitization according to some legislations. So we deal with a pure intellectual property, which can be fractionalized, you know, like infinite times. In the United States, there is a rule which is called Howey rule, according to which if there are a series of, how to say, points that are that you can tick the box, then you qualify as a security. So in Europe, this is not the case. I mean, we spoke with we are in contact with the regulator here in Italy. Sorry, in Luxembourg also, we spoke with the Italian one and with other regulators. And this is not the case. So in Europe, it's much easier from this point of view.
Synchronized is sponsored by Ames, an AI-based music similarity search created by seasoned production music insiders. Ames has also launched auto tagging. So visit AimesAPI.com to get 100 tracks tagged for free.
What I'm wondering, I mean, if a rights owner sells part of his rights through Anode Music, then you need to get the money from the PROs, various PROs in the world. It can be 5, 10, 20, I don't know. So you're depending a lot on how those PROs perform.
True. True is true.
Isn't that one of the biggest risks for this whole system? Because...
Yes. It's a risk from this point of view. I would suggest to call it just as many investors would call it an inefficiency, meaning that you have a lot of what are called middlemen by people that don't understand the music business. They think that, you know, all these people that somehow are present and from the moment the music is consumed to the moment that it reaches the pockets of the person that actually created it, there are many intermediaries. I honestly, instead, from my, I to say, naive point of view, I think that instead it's amazing because making sure that actually any time that somebody plays music in a wedding or, you know, again, in streaming platforms, online, in radio, in television, in the movies, and so on and so forth, there is actual rights generation that finally reaches the pockets of the creators. I think it's something that for sure requires many players, many people actually there. So, you know, PROs have been doing, most PROs that have been there for many decades, some of them, the majority of them for centuries, I mean, at least some in Europe. So, you know, they are somehow the columns, you know, on which the music business is working.
But don't you think that the future of music is direct licensing? I mean, making a direct deal with Spotify, because they know which song was played and how many times.
Definitely, and the blockchain is going to help out in this process, for sure. This is, you know, the magic wand which is finally arriving in the music business. It's called blockchain. Are we there already? No, not yet. So the blockchain, you know, you still need to have many players agreeing and, you know, understanding what is the format, what is the system that you're going to use, the technology. So yeah, for sure, we're going in that direction. We're seeing a lot of actually effort in going there. Also from many PROs and CMOs that actually want to modernize themselves, as they have been doing in the last decades. Because I know about some PROs that just 5 or 10 years ago, they were still using, fax.
Fax machines.
Fax machines. I mean, at the end of the day, something that maybe in normal business 20, 25 years ago, people dropped. And now, I mean, so somehow they're trying to cope. And I think many of them are really making huge steps forward in innovation.
I still use fax. You know, I use it to send smileys to Simon.
I've never received one, Ferry, because I don't have a fax machine.
Ah, that's the reason why you never get a reply.
I think I sold it 30 years ago, Ferry.
Marcio, what's the ideal situation when you look at making money with music? You're talking about blockchain. So do you think that the future for composers and publishers is a situation whereby when a song is being played, you get paid almost immediately?
Yeah, this is definitely something which is not that, I mean, where is the music going to be played though? Let's be careful here because everybody's is thinking about streaming now, but when you have radio plays or when you have TV plays or when you have synchronization with a movie or something like this, it's more complex, of course, in terms of immediate stream of royalties. But yeah, for sure, you can have much faster. And then already there are already some players, some of which we're speaking with them, that are ranging royalty payouts on a daily basis. So definitely this is where the future is going. Question, is that really so relevant? I mean, of course, if you receive your royalties with 2 years you know, in arrears, that's a problem. But receiving them maybe with a quarter of difference, I mean, I don't think that's... Also, this is preventing, which is something which can be complicated to manage, which is paying out somebody, and then at the end of the day, I didn't do the reconciliation, and actually I should have maybe paid another player. So I think that this kind of two months or 3 months, like, they are there to remain. I mean, I would suggest.
Who's going to be the major player in that field?
The major player in the future for royalty distribution? I think we will still see the PROs that we have right now, you know, just maybe a little bit more technologically advanced. But for sure, I mean, their know-how, they're machines. I mean, at the end of the day, there are a lot of very talented people that do this on a daily basis, that have all the interest in actually making this be more efficient and faster. So I'm sure that they will be there even in 50 years.
So you think that they'll still be territorially based? Because from what Ferry and I have asked, you know, the territories are breaking down, really. We're talking globally. So you don't think there's a possibility, say, of one global PRO or several global competing PROs?
Probably they will be much more interconnected, but I promise you that the music business is very local still. And also right now, as I see it right now, I still think that, it's very relevant, you know, to still see, you know, somehow territories and differences.
So how's China looking for you?
Very little information on Chinese market of music, honestly. I see that there are many players in Europe, many players, like, for example, you see Believe right now is committing to a development more in the Asian market. They did a bunch of acquisitions there. So for sure, the general Asian market is something which that will become much more relevant. Also, the African one, definitely. Regarding the Chinese specific one, I don't have many informations to actually engage in a very interesting conversation now.
Yeah. So principally, you see Europe as the big market at the moment, and then America coming in, and then Asia following and Africa following. I mean, in your kind of global plan, is that the scheme?
Well, actually, I think that, you need to speak about maturity of markets, right? So I think that the most mature ones are definitely the US and UK, where you really have instead a lot of inefficiencies. Also, in terms of pricing of catalogs, is Europe. There are many local markets in Europe where there is a lot of, again, education, as I was mentioning before, that can be done. And then in terms of growth of the industry, I really think that emerging markets are still emerging. So, you know, high level of penetration there of major streaming platforms and distribution channels makes sense.
So you mentioned blockchain. Do you see cryptocurrencies playing any part going forward with you guys?
Oh, yes. With us or with the music industry in general?
Well, both.
You already see that there are some record labels playing some artists, you know, in Bitcoin and other currencies. So I think that the cryptocurrencies, but in any sector, especially the financial one, I think that, blockchain is going to have a much more relevant importance, this concept of decentralization of information. You will not need, you know, to rely on one player that has all the information. So I think that there are so many applications of the technology, starting from how people are paid and how it's going to be easier, you know, to exchange money. You know that we have an investor who is from Canada, and we had to, you know, to send a transfer to him, and we were charged, he was charged 3.5%. Doesn't seem to be a huge amount, you know, in the Forex exchange, but for pretty
Depends
important
on the
amounts,
amount.
It started to be. Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So there are many other solutions that, especially with blockchain, that actually make this not zero, but really meaningless. So is this going to impact the industry? Yes, as well.
Yeah,
3.5% is actually pretty low. We have sub-publishers all over the world, and we sometimes, it's 10%. You know, you're losing 10% of the payment, PayPal, banks, or name it.
Not only that, we get money, say, from, I don't know, say Japan, and you're paying 7%, and then you're distributing it to composers all over the world, and each one of them, you're paying 5, 6, 7% again. So, I mean, it's a massive problem, really, that we see. And nobody's really seems to have cracked it yet. There are different platforms to bring it down, but I think you're right. Blockchain is the one where it's actually going to come down to nearer zero than...
Yeah, I mean, consider that, in the blockchain, if you want to buy the major cryptocurrencies, or if you want to pay with them, you still have to pay fees right now, because you have what is called the gas fee and all of this, right? Also, the major exchanges, they make money this way, you know, when you send and when you receive. But of course, I mean, transactions, for example, with Tether and with stable coins that are cheap. Anyway, what I would like to suggest, without going to blockchain, try Wise. We don't want to make... Wise is amazing,
Yeah.
That's absolutely amazing.
Well. Yeah. No, we've
very good.
So, Marzio, Ferry and I both own catalogs. We're great friends. We're also competitors. And that that competition keeps us sharp. It keeps us on the track. So I wonder, who have you got competitors? I mean, can you see people coming up behind you?
Oh, yeah, that's a very nice topic. So you send to each other faxes, you know?
We send faxes. We still send faxes. Yeah.
Well, we're friends. I mean, we've been business partners for 30 years, but we do own libraries that, of course, do compete in the marketplace. And that competition is part of our strength. Because we have to keep ourselves sharp and competitive. So I'm interested to know whether you have kind of completely cornered the market, or whether you see yourself as part of a group of, you know, like us, it's going to end up with a bunch of competing platforms.
Yeah. No. I mean, first of all, I think that competition is always great, you know, especially when you do something for the first time in Europe, for example, and you see other players actually coming out, you say, oh yeah, actually I was through then. I was right. You know, like, it's actually interesting what we're doing. There are other players doing it, you know, like, kind of a confirmation that of the value proposition that you have. So somehow, as a reassurance, you know, you're not alone in the universe. you hit this moment. There are players in the United States that deal with there are marketplaces of music rights, of music catalogs. Right now, you also have some platforms active in the, you know, NFT arena and tokenization of music rights that are starting to surface. I think it's great innovation, indeed, the blockchain and tokenization of music rights. It's the way that will, the industry will go in the future towards it.
Are you going to remain specializing in music, or might you go to art and video and other areas, or use really a music platform?
Well, I can already tell you that the music industry is already taking a huge amount of energies, so it's really a big market. Especially in Europe, where it's so fragmented. It's amazing how, you know, when you enter into a different country, you find totally different, way of doing business. So we already have a lot to do in the music business right now. I don't exclude anything in the future, though.
No, because my point, if we go back to albums, vinyl in the 70s and 80s, it was about the music, but it was also about the pictures. It was partly a visual medium. And in a way, that's kind of died because of shrinkage to a CD, and now streaming, there's no visual element. And I think there's a vacuum there now, and artists will become people who do music and visuals. I don't think there's anything that says specifically music is just that in that box. Creative people will do what they want, and they might at some point create visuals at the same time as they create music.
Yeah. I mean, let's speak about this as kind of the image rights. Is it something maybe you refer to? Yeah, I mean, image rights is also another huge, huge niche. So not that much niche. It's like a real market, which is very much not understood, and which is many times not properly monetized. And our business is also focused on that. For example, we listed in July the image rights of a very popular band from Italy, connected to the monetization of their concerts and public appearance. So in this case, it's whenever they do a concert, you can attribute a portion of whatever cachet they receive as the image rights. You know, like, a portion is for the performance, the other portion is for the image rights. Mm. So hence, you can monetize this portion, these royalties, by selling it as if it was a music right at the end of the day, because you still generate royalties, you know, just by the fact that a band which is famous is going around and making concerts. So yeah, image rights are going to be, especially with all the talks of the metaverse. You already saw, I don't remember which, I mean, there was a major I think 2 weeks ago purchased the image rights of a very famous artist. I don't remember specifically, I read the news passing by. But I think this is going to be very, very relevant. Mm-hmm. So not just the music, the specific compositions, master rights or publishing rights, whatever, but also, you know, the likeness of the artist.
Yeah.
Basically, you just said the magic word, NFT. Can you elaborate on that? It stands for non-fungible token.
As far as I know.
What exactly is it? And why do people pay money for that?
So the NFT is, technically speaking, again, sorry for going to the boring side, but I think it's kind of important also to understand where the word comes from, indeed.
We're in the production music industry. That's boring. So
amazing. Okay, so the NFT, technically speaking, it's a contract. I mean, it's something, let's say, that you write in a blockchain representing ownership or representing an asset or representing a virtual asset. So when you say the NFT of, I don't know, my phone, is because I create a contract that represent my phone. So, of course, I have one phone, so I have one NFT of the phone, let's say. So the NFT is somehow a unique representation of something. And so, you know, people that are in the technology, in the blockchain business, they say, okay, at the end of the day, I can represent ownership of anything through the blockchain. So that's why it's becoming so interesting and so, how to say, widespread. Because it's not somehow it's becoming more important to be able to claim ownership of my phone, for example, in the blockchain, which is perceived as immutable, rather than holding my phone itself that people can steal from me. But then in the blockchain, it's always going to be me until the moment that I actually sell this NFT. So this application is actually being used for trading art, for example, that you can somehow represent a real picture with an NFT in the blockchain, claiming for which you can claim ownership. And then the business went further, and so they said, okay, let's also represent virtual art. So even if you don't hold the asset or there is no asset at all, this NFT represents, I don't know, a PNG or a picture that you can just load on the internet, but you can represent ownership of that. And so this in the music business has direct applications because you can somehow with an NFT, so writing in a blockchain, ownership of a composition that you made or of a master right, you know, and somehow determining in an, how to say, immutable way, who owns the specific without actually having to go through the PRO. So this is where everything comes from. And, you know, the NFT business is going to, I think, very impact the music business a lot in many different ways. First of all, new revenue sources like collectibles. Artists can sell their image rights or a representation of the image rights or the picture of them, I don't know, taking a shower or whatever doing through an NFT. And people are going to pay that, you know, as they were trading cards. Then you can also use NFTs to give rewards to people holding a specific NFT. You hold the NFT number 003 of artist XYZ, okay, you have a 5% discount at all his concerts. Or you can meet him once a year or whatever. And then there is also the last part, which is ownership of the music right, the more boring part, which is, let's say, also what we focus on, which is representing the music right ownership through NFTs. Not really through NFTs themselves, but through tokenized NFTs. Because let's remember that ownership of music rights can be divided, you know, many times. So,
okay. So, for example, we have our own catalog. It's called Blink. There are 1,000 recordings in that catalog. I can create NFTs for each of those recordings.
Correct, but you can also create one NFT representing the catalog itself. I mean, the NFT at the end of the day is just a bunch of zeros and ones that the computer or a blockchain somehow assigns to you in the blockchain, you know, in this ledger which says who owns what. So the moment that you create it, you can create an NFT, you can create a contract in the blockchain, and you are the one saying what this contract actually refers to. So if you wanted to refer to your contract, now there's a big debate whether this direction is bilateral. So an NFT represents, you know, for example, one of the compositions in your album, in your catalog. Is the reverse true? Meaning, if you sell, for example, one of the songs you own, then the NFT at the same time should exchange hands. But if you sell the NFT, does it mean that also the songs that you own? This is not the case right now. So legally speaking, and from a regulatory standpoint, and you know, nationally speaking, in all the laws, there is no bidirectional. So you cannot yet, the moment that you transfer an NFT to represent something, you cannot claim that you have transferred underlying asset.
Okay, so if you sell an NFT, what do you actually sell then?
right now you're selling, it depends. Did you hear the case of Quentin Tarantino, that he was creating an NFT that would give the holder access to a series of, non-release cuts of one of his movies? And he was about to put this on the market, and then he was sued by, I think it was Miramax, because they were saying, we actually produce a movie together with you. I mean, we should actually receive a portion of that. So there is a lot of, let's say, fog and, confusion. It's a wild west right now. So technically speaking, when you sell an NFT, you're selling nothing than a bunch of zeros and ones that you say, and actually the buyer is somehow acknowledging and thinking that it represents something in real life or maybe a virtual asset, but then the law says different. So you should actually write a contract at the same time saying, I'm transferring you this asset. Hey, at the same time, I'm transferring you the NFT that represents this asset.
Interesting. So can I just look at a slightly different side of the business, Marcia? For us, production music libraries, a great problem in the past has been piracy, and that to some extent has been mitigated by watermarking and detection software of music. So at the moment, that's what we're very involved in. Are you involved in that? I mean, is piracy a problem for you guys, and is detection software something that you use, or is this all hands-off by your clients?
No, this is not something that we deal with. We basically take the music industry and the revenue generation of the catalog as is. So we don't, let's say, have a say in the day-to-day administration or piracy detection. And by the way, I kind of disagree with you, because I think that what really, defeated piracy is not, a direct weapon against piracy, but is user experience. So I don't know when, probably it was in 2011, 2012 or something, it became more convenient for people actually to go on Spotify and stream whatever song that they wanted rather than going and downloading it from BitTorrent or Emuladunance and whatever other peer-to-peer. So I think that this easier, the best way to actually defeat piracy is through easy user experience for the users. Mm. Then, of course, what you're saying totally makes sense, because what prevents me at that moment from uploading on streaming on a streaming platform something that you produced? So this is where the anti-piracy and watermarking, as you were saying, come into effect. But I think that the primary weapon against piracy is better user experience, so that you don't have to go through piracy.
You're basically referring to when it all started, the illegal downloading. There was no legal alternative, right? The record companies, the publishing companies, they didn't have a legal alternative.
Exactly.
So just... slightly playing devil's advocate here. So we had one of our previous guests, a guy called Noah Becker, who owns AdRev, and AdRev monetized YouTube. And in order to do a bit of homework, I requested my platform to give me details of the last 50,000 illegal uses of our music on YouTube. And that represents 50,000 times £150 each go, quite a few millions of lost income. And I was surprised that there were. In fact, there are many more than 50,000 of my catalogue, and each one of those usages, it has a monetary value if you can go back and get a license off these people. So there is piracy, and there is kind of YouTube is letting it all happen. In a sense, they're kind of saying, "Help yourself. We'll do a bit of monetization through AdRev, so everybody's happy. You'll get 0.001p every time somebody's used it." And because we were speaking to Noah, I thought, hang on, I'm not happy with 0.001p. I want £150 usage. So I've started doing that, and it worked. I mean, not everybody wants, some people will take their videos down, but some people will go, oh, I don't want to be a pirate. I didn't realize I was a pirate. I just used it. So that's, if I was one of your catalog, that's what's going on behind the scenes, is me making extra income for you guys from challenging pirates. But you could have an investor say, yeah, look, I've got Blink, I've taken shares in Blink, and I'm not happy because I've seen millions of usages of Blink music on YouTube that are not being monetized. So who's going to collect it? Are you going to say, Ferry, it's your job to collect it? Or is the investor going to say, well, I think it's Anote's job, isn't it, to...
Somehow definitely we need to protect, and we need to make sure that everybody's in best conditions to actually properly monetize and make sure that there is no improper usage or listening of. And this is also why I was always saying before, we focus on, especially when we put on the platform, it's a limited share, a minority share, because who you know, who better than you knows how to protect, how to make sure that you remain, you know, the in charge. And the castle at the end of the day is something that you guys built. So there is no investor that can actually come. Maybe, but even when you give them, maybe it's something that is not always true. But even when you give and when you sell to another publisher, I mean, there is not always an increase in monetization, even if this publisher is 10 times bigger, because maybe they have less, you know, kind of emotional attachment, or they have less people working on the catalog. So, you know, this kind of things that, and also the information you just gave me, I mean, for example, before I was mentioning to the general piracy and illegal downloads, but you said something indeed which is still very relevant, which is preventing usage on YouTube, which is...
Yeah. One question. It seems to me you don't make any distinction really between any type of music. It's just, to you, it's music. And yet to us, it's a very big distinction, because our music, the reason our music gets used is because it's easier and it's cheaper. And I'm not sure that distinction is going to continue, because it's just, as you see it, I think I see it like you in a way. It's just music. It's good music, bad music, useful music, not useful music. So I wonder if... following this conversation, you're going to make more of a distinction between production music and commercial music, or whether you just kind of go, do you know what? I just don't see that, you know, it's just music to me.
Yeah, this is it's a very, very interesting and quite philosophical concept of music as a commodity.
Yeah.
Which is something I disagree with. I think that music is something that, if you listen to music, there is a reason. And so there is a reason if you keep listening to the same song, you say, okay, when you meet people, you ask them, okay, where are you from? How old are you? I don't know, what's your favorite food and what's your favorite music? I mean, any composition and any interpretation also the same song, and whether used for whatever reasons, I think is really individual. So I'm totally against call it commercial or production music as kind of, you know, creating this commodity. But also the way that it's sold, I think it's very, very relevant to keep this, to remove the concept of music as a commodity. Of course, when you see 60,000 tracks uploading on Spotify every day, I mean, everybody's like, okay, that's a huge number. But I think that this is going to plateau sooner or later.
Oh, do you?
At least that's I think so.
Yeah, interesting.
I got a question for you. We're almost coming to the end of this episode, but I've got a question for you. A lot of people listening right now who own songs or catalogs or part of catalogs, why just give them a pitch? Why should they come and try to monetize their music through Anode Music?
Why they should try? Well, I think it's a
when,
great
when should
way
they do it?
When should they do it? That's also another point. I think it's very, very interesting right now to look at how the trend is, how the business is evolving, how the participation of the fan base and how this kind of deeper engagement with the fan base or with investors that can, you know, be beneficial in many ways. Can be beneficial because you can potentially increase the valuation of your catalog itself, because the moment that you, for example, sell 10% or 5% of it at a multiple of 10, 15, it's also something important. You can go to a bank and actually say, okay, this is the price of my catalog. You know that before, when I was telling you that I wanted a loan to actually invest in new music, you didn't listen to me. You didn't think that actually it had a value. Right now, indeed, I see I have 1,000 people or whatever that actually paid for this and are receiving royalties every time. So this is also a very financial component. And then it's the branding that comes with your catalog. I mean, being recognized and being, you know, being there and being, you know, having its sticker on our marketplace. We see that also something that is very important for renovating your brand as a record label, as a producer, as a publisher, as a songwriter. The visibility that comes with it is very important as well. So you have a series of components, some of them encompassing, you know, the financial components, financial motivations, reasons. Sometimes there are fiscal reasons. You know that most of the times when the last big deals, mega deals that you saw, starting from, you know, I don't know, Neil Young, for example, they say that some of the reasons were also fiscal, because they wanted to monetize before there is an increase in tax rates in the United States. So there are many indeed reasons for participation to the market. And right now valuations are high. So some people are just interested in cashing out. You know, they're reaching peaks. And according to some investment banking reports that we have been looking at, it's going to last for another 2 years, but then the window probably is going to close, because the growth in the music business is going to slightly decline. This is what at least we have been seeing.
So buy soon.
So buy soon, sell soon, sell soon. Participate soon. Exactly. Do everything as soon as possible. It's what we say, you know, when you can speak with my teamwork, you know, with my team, we always ask to do things by yesterday. And this is an advice I say to everyone, whatever the occasion.
What kind of people invest in music? Are we talking about big investors or also just private people who just want to see how it goes, how it works?
Both. It's very interesting, the latest category, you know. You know when you have a swimming pool in front of you, you don't know whether the water is cold or not. So what do? You start with your toe, right, with the tip of the toe. And then you start receiving some royalties, you know. So this first 100 euros, they actually grow more, and 500 and 1,000. So we are seeing many, many investors that actually start, and we have more or less in just 6 months or something, 40% of the people that have already invested more than once. So we see a lot of this, you know, kind of, oh, surprise, I'm receiving rights. Oh, it's true then. Of course it is. So it's, you know, I think that, I don't know, maybe in something again, saying something exaggerated, but there are not two things that are sure in life that usually people say, it's death and taxes. I would add also a third one, which is royalties at the end of the day. As long as the PROs are actually continuing with what we were saying before.
So just following up on Ferry's question, do your investors invest in specific catalogues exclusively, or do you offer funds which spread out the investment across a number of catalogues?
Ma, it's, I mean, diversification is always key, is important. Huh? So they can buy a share of this catalog and then another one, then maybe they like a specific singer, a specific artist, a specific catalog, so they would buy, they put more money in that one, but it's usually we see diversification across catalogs.
But do you have middlemen, fund managers who kind of play your market and No,
right now it's...
You're trying to get rid of the middleman, Simon, and now you're introducing the middleman again.
I'm interested, Ferry. I'm fascinated. I think it's a great idea, and I think people will do that. I mean, I could see myself being a fund manager in that case, because I would know a bit more about some of the publishing companies than the average investor would, correct?
Yeah. No, definitely. I mean, it's something that probably in the future we would have this development done. So far, it's only peer-to-peer, let's say.
Yeah. Great. Well, I'm going to get my checkbook out immediately. Oh, checkbook. We don't use checkbooks anymore, do we?
Exactly. Are you going to fax the check?
I'll get some Bitcoin out immediately.
One last question, Marcio. The future of the music industry, does it look bright?
I think so. I really think so. I mean, at the end of the day, the music business is a soundtrack of our lives. And I think when we were doing the testing, I told you that I'm really listening a huge amount of music every day. You know, when I work, I listen to the soundtracks, for example. I love soundtracks. In spring, I start listening to Italian music, and then in the start of summer. So I think this kind of music consumption habits is there, going there to stay. And the user experience that I was mentioning before is something that people forget, how easy it is right now to listen to music and to be exposed to music and to, again, the metaverse. And we are going to spend much more time online, and we are going to be needing a lot of soundtracks for that. Otherwise, it keeps boring. Silence. Let's stay silent for 1 second. It's boring. You don't want to do it. Exactly. Doesn't make sense.
I want to thank you for your time. It was a great chat, I think. Very interesting. And if people have any questions, they can direct them to us, and we'll get in touch with you, if that's okay?
Of course, for sure.
So your site is anote.com, correct?
Anotemusic.com.
Anotemusic.com.
And do you know, by the way, why Anote? Let's see if it comes to your mind.
Is it to do with concert A?
A note, one note. So it's the atomic portion of a song, which is one note, A note.
Okay.
So since we fragment ownership of music rights, let's call it with the atomic element of a song, which
Excellent.
Is one note.
A note. Anotemusic.com. Go there.
Exactly.
Thank you very much, and I hope to talk to you soon.
Thank you, Ferry. Thank you, Simon. Okay. Great
Thanks,
to be
Marcia.
Here.
Great to talk to you.